Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, August 26th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Higher education is facing a crisis, and there's not just one problem or one issue, but a flurry of them. Let me list a few. Unaffordable tuition, cuts in public funding, declines in enrollment, AI disruptions in the classroom, political interference, opaque admissions, and all these things have led to a historic loss in public trust.
That was a long list, Kevin.
Thanks, yeah. Debbie.
And so more and more families are questioning the value of college. They're asking, can I find a good career without a four-year degree and racking up a mountain of debt? And there's a coming demographic cliff. With declining birth rates, schools are bracing for steep drops in enrollment. So today, for this month's Big Fix episode, we are trying to fix our higher education system.
And we've invited in three guests to pitch their ideas for reforming our colleges and universities. They'll each present two ideas over the course of the hour that we'll hash out as a group. Mm-hmm. Today we have Julie Wallman, President Emerita of Widener University and Professor of Practice at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for being in studio, Julie.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Tyler Austin Harper. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic Magazine and a former college professor. Tyler, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Jeff Salingo, author of Dream School, Finding the College That's Right for You. And he's also a special advisor to the president at Arizona State University. Jeff, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and of course, you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, we'd love to hear from you as well. Our big questions of the day: what do you think are the biggest problems facing higher education, and what's one thing you would fix? Give us a call and share your thoughts. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, hello, you can put your big ideas in the live chat.
But before we launch into that conversation about big fixes, I want to shout out that it's Giveaway Wednesday. All summer, we're giving out tickets to great events in our region. Stick around, and towards the end of the show, we'll reveal this week's event and give you a chance to win. And Cherry, it's a good one.
I know. I can't wait till y'all hear it. So we're going to jump right into the show. I'm just going to explain to our big thinkers how it works. Again, we have three big thinkers: Julie, Tyler, Jeffrey. Each of you have two big ideas. We're going to have two rounds where each of you presents one of your big ideas. Julie, we're going to start with you and your first big idea. You say public trust in higher education has declined because there's a lot of misconceptions. Lay out the problem as you see it and your big fix.
Great. Thank you so much. So I think the problem is we have a major misunderstanding of what the higher education sector is. Mm-hmm. Because we focus so much on the most elite institutions, which educate about 1% of the students in this country, we are not aware as a public of what the higher education sector consists of or what it does. So at the large, large majority, about 97% of institutions in this country that are not the highly selective, not the highest ranked, that not in the top 100 institutions in this country, the tuition is often much more affordable than mm-hmm. it is at the most elite institutions, particularly if they're public institutions. The amount of financial aid given, you have nearly every student receiving financial aid. There's a significant attention to workforce preparation, which is not the only thing that these institutions are doing, but they're aware that students need, they're there to get a return on their investment in coming to college. And it's an investment. Even if you don't pay a lot of tuition, you're taking 4 years without working. Mm-hmm. So, or more if it takes a little longer to graduate. So we need to be focused on the outcomes. These are things that the majority of institutions in this country are doing, and yet the focus is so much on the highly selective institutions.
So you're almost saying like colleges and universities writ large need some sort of like PR campaign.
Absolutely.
To redefine who they are. So how do you do that? What's the fix?
Absolutely. So I think there's a couple things that we mm-hmm. need to do. We haven't gotten the information out there very effectively. So I think we need to think as higher education faculty, staff, and leaders, how we can collaborate. And collaboration is very difficult in higher education because mm-hmm. we're very competitive, especially given all the challenges, particularly yeah. the demographic cliff, the enrollment challenges. But we have got to collaborate to reset the public understanding of what higher education is and what it does and the value it offers to local communities and to individuals. And I think we also have to, we have to hold ourselves accountable. We have not done a good job of that. But I think we also need our news media to help us with that, because so much of the focus mm-hmm. of what's in the news is about the most elite institutions. As an example, when the Students for Fair Admissions decision was before the Supreme Court a few years ago, you could listen to mainstream, very reliable media talking about how every institution uses affirmative action in admissions. That's actually not true at all. Mm-hmm. The great majority of institutions admit every student who's qualified. They're not open admissions, but they admit every student who meets their admissions requirements. Mm-hmm. But you would think from the news reporting that everyone uses affirmative action, that every school is highly selective, expensive. So I think it's a collaboration.
And Julie, I want you to quickly just explain why this matters. Why does it matter that the public, politicians, journalists, for example, you say the media does this. Why does it matter that there's this misunderstanding about what a vast majority of higher education institutions do?
Because I think a big part of the lack of trust and the lack of legislative support, political support, funding for schools is because there is a misunderstanding of what higher education is. And I think if people better understood the work that these institutions, the great majority of institutions, are doing to make a difference in their community, to help students get jobs, to help them advance, to help them reach their aspirations, I think there would be more support. I think we look at these ivy colored walls, exceptionally wealthy institutions. The endowment of most institutions is 1% of mm-hmm. what it is at these exceptionally wealthy mm-hmm. institutions. So there isn't a lot of money. The faculty and staff are working very hard with the students, one-on-one attention, really helping them to achieve their goals and to be successful. People don't understand this. They think of the Ivy color.
They think of the Harvard.
Exactly.
I think part of what you're getting at too is like the conception out there, maybe the stuff that's been generating headlines a lot in recent years is this culture war stuff around, hot button issues and are colleges too liberal? And you're saying that conversation is really happening at a select amount of schools and it's not writ large in the system. Let's bring in Tyler Austin Jeff, Harper, who could maybe speak to that. He had a big cover article for The Atlantic magazine. Tyler, what's your take? Are you into what Julie is pitching here, or do you think that there is something deeper that needs to be talked about?
Yeah, I agree in a qualified sense. I agree 100% that the media often has a very distorted picture of what the higher ed landscape looks like. I was also frustrated in the wake of the unraveling of affirmative action that this was portrayed as something that was going to impact universities around the country rather than this very small slice that was mentioned, right? So I do think there is a problem in the media of generalizing from the elite schools to education writ large. I also would offer a qualified defense and say that one of the reasons why I think the media focuses on elite schools too much, but I also think at the same time, these are the schools that furnish our senators. These are the schools that staff our most powerful institutions in the country. And I understand that everyone's sick of Harvard. I'm sick of writing about Harvard, but it is just a simple fact of life, right?
The influence that many,
the influence is astronomical, right? And if you think of the media as an organ that is trying to hold power to account, or at least think about what it's doing, I think perhaps you can definitely argue that there's too much focus on the Ivy League, but I think there's also some good reasons why that is the case.
And Jeff, I wanted to get Jeff's thoughts before we pivot on to the next big fix from you, Tyler. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I both agree and disagree. I think one of the things is, first of all, I wrote a piece for The Atlantic a couple of months ago that shows that most students in the U.S. go to college within 50 miles of home. So most students are doing exactly what Julie talks about, is that they're really only thinking about their local institutions. Those might be community colleges, those might be regional publics or regional privates. So there's a little bit of, yes, the national media does focus on the elite institutions. I agree with Tyler, because they do furnish, you know, a lot of our leaders, but that's what also is why American higher education is so known around the world, right? We should both celebrate our open access institutions, but we also should celebrate the best institutions that we have developed over 200 plus years in the US. We should not denigrate either of them, in my my opinion. In terms of local institutions, again, you know, Julie's talking about the media. I will tell you, you know, I've covered higher education for more than 25 years. Some of the hardest people to talk with are people at community colleges and regional publics. They often don't want to tell their story. And so I also want, especially if those leaders are listening, that they're willing, when the media does call them, to tell their story more
often. Pick up the phone.
Yeah. Tyler, let me give you a chance to finish the thought you were about to make before we jump into your first big fix idea.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, the thing I do resist somewhat is that I think there's been a real effort on both the left and right to portray the problem is, like, we just need different kinds of coverage of these institutions, and we need more focus on different kinds of schools or whatever. And I really think the whole problem in the higher ed sector is the political economy, right? That it is broken, and it is broken not just at the elite schools, it is also broken at these smaller institutions as well, where students are, yes, getting a better value for a degree than they are at an institution that charges $100,000 a year, but where you still have a lot of students getting a college degree only to become a barista at Starbucks, right? And I think the collapse of these universities, which is not just at the elite schools, but also at the small ones and the poorer ones, as levers for social mobility, it is not a PR problem, right? That is causing the decline in trust. It is that hundreds of thousands of people around the country have a lived experience of sending their kids to all these kinds of schools, mostly not elite ones, and it not being worth it for them.
Yeah. All right, Tyler, do you want to jump into your first big fix idea, since we're kind of up against time here?
Yeah, go right ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, I would have all colleges pull out of providing data to U.S. News and World Report, the college ranking system. I think U.S. News and World Report rankings create tons of perverse incentives for these sorts of institutions, ranging from large scale to small scale. A trivial one, but that one that's really significant, right? We talk a lot about grade inflation, that there's problems of grade inflation at universities around the country. Well, one of the reasons there's grade inflation is because it's basically impossible to fail students. Administrators don't want to fail students.
That is
one reason
true.
They don't want to fail students is not because they are soft, right? It is because if they fail too many students, that's going to increase their time to degree rate. Mm-hmm. And if they increase their time to degree rate, that's going to impact their U.S. News and World Report ranking. So you have an incentive structure that actually militates against rigor, because if you are rigorous, you will have students who don't complete classes. They need to take an extra semester, and that will hurt your college ranking. There are also bigger picture problems this causes too, a kind of arms race among different sorts of institutions, where they're all competing to spend more and more money, get nicer and nicer dorms, etc., in the hopes that they get a marginal increase in their overall rankings, right? So I think this the ranking fetish introduces all sorts of dysfunction. And I think one added piece is that leads us to the belief, actually to piggyback on a point that was made earlier, that the elite institutions are the best institutions. And it depends what you mean by best, right? Mm-hmm. If you mean the most likely to produce a six-figure job, sure. But what does Harvard exist to do? Well, Harvard exists to reproduce the American ruling class. It exists to send people to Google, consulting, finance, big tech, right? 50% of Harvard graduates and Ivy League graduates go into those kinds of lines of work. Those are not pro-social lines of work that are making the world better largely, right? And so what does it mean when we say our quote-unquote most highly ranked institutions in the country are also some of the institutions that are responsible for some of the most grievous problems in this country, right? So I think it's bad for a number of reasons.
I want to push you a little bit, Tyler, because, I mean, I want to talk about the actual consumer of higher education, the families, the parent, the students. I mean, don't they want rankings? Don't they want... How would they differentiate between universities if there's no rankings, if there's no, you can't say who does what? Like, what would be the alternative to this?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing stopping institutions from providing their own data about, hey, here's what our class size looks like. If this is something that's important to you, we might be a good fit for you. Here's the, you know, the industries that we've sent our graduates to if you major in XYZ major, right? Universities can still advocate for themselves, but it would force them to make a case about why this particular institution is right for your son or daughter, rather than, hey, we are ranked 2 points higher from Bowdoin, right, than Bowdoin, right? So you should come here, or we're 4 points higher than Amherst, or we've climbed 3 points in the rankings from last year, right? Those aren't really good reasons.
And another follow-up is somebody who went to multiple institutions and got like all kinds of degrees. Like, I mean, part of it is, how do you sort of get the employers out of this? Because part of it is, you know, if you go to certain law schools, the law firms are looking at the top ranked blah, blah, blah. If you go to certain corporations, they're looking at the top ranked, you know, graduates from these ranked schools. It seems like this, it breaks a whole system. You could tell the universities to tap out. But when you have students and parents and everybody else and employers looking at that, so how do you break that wheel as well?
I think it's a good question, but I also think it's breaking up a little bit already because of artificial intelligence and because of a number of other culture war issues that have been mentioned, right? I think there are already a lot of employers that are looking differently at elite schools and thinking, you know what, actually, maybe I'm going to take a flyer on this kid from a public school, right? Because I've seen some of the things that's going on at elite schools. I've read the surveys that say, you know, a significant percentage of these students are cheating their way through a four-year degree. Maybe I'm going to take the plucky kid who's worked two jobs and is at a state school rather than a Harvard grad.
Well, Jeff, you're a special advisor, Jeff.
Idea.
Are you going to whisper in the Arizona State University president's ear and say we're going to pull out?
I like Tyler's point because it's really the thesis of my last book, which was really to give parents permission to think more broadly about what makes a good college. And, you know, and one of the facts, Sherry, you just mentioned employers, you know, we have data in that book that shows the Fortune 50, for example, hire from all different selectivities of colleges, right? It's not just the top ranked colleges. But more than that, in that book, We looked at a survey that's done every year called the National Survey of Student Engagement. It basically shows how students engage in their learning, how they engage with professors. And one of the things that we found from that data, this is data from 1,200 colleges and universities, unfortunately not given to US News, so it doesn't take part in the rankings, unfortunately, is that, for example, at less selective schools, students have more faculty interaction than they have at the most selective schools, right? Where sometimes, and not at places that Tyler has taught, but, you know, at these big research universities, often the professors are more interested in their research and their graduate students than in undergraduates. And these are questions that the rankings don't get at, that when I speak to parents about this, I'm talking to them about the things they should be looking for and an undergraduate education.
But do you think it's realistic to have Arizona State pull out of the rankings?
Well, the thing is that whether you pull out of the rankings or not, there's all this data that, you know, I got my start in higher education reporting in 1994 as an intern, as a summer intern on the U.S. News and World Report rankings. And the fact of the matter is there's all this federal government data that colleges have to report to the U.S. government that U.S. News will take anyway, right? Whether you participate in the rankings or not.
Yeah, and Julie, I know you were chomping at the bit. Jump in.
Yeah, so I would really agree that the rankings do create perverse incentives. I think some of that is just related even to admissions. Who's admitted? The idea that we get as many applications as we can at elite institutions and we reject as many as we can instead of thinking about how can we help students be successful. There's a question about who's served. We don't see that in the rankings. So these other institutions are serving commuter students. They're serving part-time working students, as Jeff said. They're serving parenting students, non-traditional age students. So they have much more flexibility. Social mobility, I think, is key here. And I think Tyler was talking about that as well, that, you know, you could have a ranking that focused on social mobility. That would be much more useful than the U.S. News and World Report. And there are some alternative rankings that are out there.
Yeah.
But the other thing I think we see at these other institutions is that they're focused on the work. The internships are built into the curriculum. I absolutely agree that there's more one-on-one attention, that the classes tend to be smaller. There's more of a focus on the individual student. And their success.
And we're going to have to leave it right there because we got to go on to a break. And we're going to hear Jeff Salingo's big idea, first big idea on the other side of this break. And of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What do you think the biggest problems facing higher education are? And what's one thing you would fix? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Janice on Facebook says, all community colleges should be free. That could be a big fix. I will, right? We'll hear from more of you. And of course, we'll hear from more of our big thinkers on the other side of the break. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCory, in for Avi Wolfman Aaron. Before we jump back into our conversation about the big fixes in higher ed, we want to let you know there's still a few tickets available for our Studio 2 live broadcast event happening tomorrow in Manayunk.
Yeah, after a decade hiatus, the Philadelphia Cycling Classic, a.k.a. the bike race, returns this weekend, and ahead of the race will be at Love City Brewing on Main Street to get the scoop from the organizers on what it took to bring that event back to life.
Tickets are free, but you need to register now at whyy.org/events to join us tomorrow at noon and be part of our live Studio 2 audience.
Yes, and I hope to see you there. So now back to our conversation about big fixes for higher ed. Let me reintroduce our guests. We have Julie Waldman here in the studio. She's president emerita of Widener University and professor of practice at the University of Pennsylvania. We also have Tyler Austin Harper, staff writer for The Atlantic and a former professor at Bates University. Last but not least, Jeff Salingo, author of Dream School, Finding the College That's Right for You, and special advisor to the president of Arizona State University.
And as always, we want to hear from you. What do you think are the biggest problems facing higher ed? And what's one thing that you would fix? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. If you're watching along on YouTube or Facebook, leave a comment in the chat.
Yeah, MJ on Facebook says, for me, the biggest issue is affordability. It boggles my mind that colleges feel the need to constantly build new buildings and flashy facilities in order to attract students. Spend that money on attracting great professors. I'm speaking mostly to prospective students and their parents. Stop being attracted by the shiny objects. A commenter on YouTube says, the problem is that society at large does not see education and knowledge as a societal benefit, instead thinking it's personal benefit only. I want to bring in a caller. We have Marilyn from Ambler on the line. Marilyn, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is to reiterate the concerns about U.S. News and World Report. I was an administrator at the University of Pennsylvania for 20 years, and I kept seeing issues that were forcing the leadership and faculty to make decisions that weren't really about what they prioritized about dealing with and supporting the students. Having to have buildings open 24 hours a day and putting more pressure and cost for security, special boutique meals, air conditioning in dorms, which we didn't have when I was growing up.
We didn't have it either, yeah.
Right. And so that it kept distracting from what leaders really wanted to do, but the impact was so great. And I even heard the representative for Moody's ratings once say that if you were at higher level on U.S. News and World Report, you earned a lower interest cost, higher rating for Moody's.
Well, thank you, Marilyn. Thank you, Marilyn, for that perspective. Thanks. Tyler, your idea is getting some traction out there, so thanks for that. But let's jump to Jeff Salingo's big idea number one. Jeff, what do you got for us?
So I want to tell families the price of college before they actually apply to college, right? So when I wrote my book, Who Gets In and Why, I spent a year inside the college admissions process at three institutions. And, you know, many of the families I met during that year would apply to college. And sometimes they apply, you know, students are now applying to 8, 9, 10 different colleges because they need to compare financial aid offers because unlike almost anything else we buy in life, we really don't know what college is going to cost us. Yes, they have this thing called sticker price, but almost nobody pays the sticker price at most colleges and universities, right? It's like going to a steakhouse and not knowing the prices on the menu, or booking a hotel room and not knowing how much it will cost. Things are starting to change. Whitman College, Brandeis, Cornell College in Iowa, they're all now telling students up front before they apply what it will cost them if they get accepted and enroll. And so rather than compete on price through tuition discounting, I think that schools should compete on fit, quality, outcomes, you know, a lot of the stuff that Tyler and Julie were talking about earlier.
Yeah. And so explain the difference for folks who may not work in higher ed. They don't know how it works. Explain the difference between the advertised sticker price, you may see it in some of the admissions, and then the amount that many students actually pay. So how is it calculated here? Because like you said,
so
a lot of
calculated
students don't pay that.
Yeah. Right. So it's calculated one of two ways. You're either going to get a financial aid based on need. So based on your financial need, you'll fill out this thing called the FAFSA, the federal application, free application for aid, and you will get money based on that. But there's also a big thing in higher ed called merit aid that gives out a lot of money, which are essentially coupons, because the sticker price might say 60, 70, 50, 40, whatever it might be. But they know that most families can't pay that, and so that even or don't want to pay that, and so they'll give a $10,000 or $15,000 quote unquote merit scholarship, which is really a coupon.
Because there's no money exchanging hands here. This is just a discount. Yeah,
exactly. It's a straight off discount. It's like Macy's giving you a 20% discount
and not even real merit
because they
like...
know you're going to spend other money.
Wow,
you're going to spend other money, but you don't know that until at the end when you get accepted to college. You don't know that up front before you even apply. Right. What you're going to pay.
So I bet everybody's for transparency around this roundtable today.
Julie's
but Julie, I'm wondering, there's got to be reasons why the system exists the way it does. This sounds like maybe it's easier said than done, or why hasn't this already happened?
I think it's a fantastic idea. I teach about this, the examples that Jeff mentioned. I think one of the interesting things is that we see some of the most interesting innovation in the admission space in the non-elite institutions, the great majority of institutions. And the enrollment challenges have forced schools like Cornell College and Whitman to provide this information up front, because then students see they can succeed. And we also have institutions that are admitting students, state institutions, students okay the look at their transcript, and they can be admitted without applying. So I would like to build on something that Jeff said, which is, not only are we the only business that doesn't tell people what it's going to cost before they try to buy something, we actually make them pay before we'll even tell them in most cases, because there's an application fee.
Yeah.
And that's just that doesn't make any sense. It's really not a reasonable way to do this.
Yeah.
So I do think we can change this. I think we have models of changing this.
But why hasn't it changed already?
Well, I think that one of the challenges is it requires a significant rethinking of how we do things. And like any organization, higher education is very attached to how we've always done things. There's a fear that if we do that, we aren't going to get the same enrollment. And so you have to take a risk and be willing to try something that is related to your mission and values and goals, which is to bring people into higher education.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder, and Tyler, you can jump in here as well. Just what do colleges and universities sort of get from this opaqueness that exists? And you talk about opaqueness in admissions, opaqueness
everything,
in how much you pay. Like there's this black box, and right. No one knows. And you put your application in, and something comes out, and you don't know what goes into that. So what is the benefit of it remaining the same?
I don't think there is any benefit, at least to the buying public. If you want to think about education as a commodity that's being purchased, I think there's probably some benefits to schools to keep those numbers opaque. I mean, I completely support this as well. I mean, I think it should be clear what all sorts of colleges cost. Mm-hmm. I think you should be able to know that up front. I think the public has an interest in knowing that, both people who are sending their kids to school and those who are not. You know, I think about this a bit, like, you know, I think it's in Europe that the front of cigarette packages have images of people with lung cancer, you know, and like, here's what your lungs look like, your teeth are all gone. And I think I sort of see this like that, right? I think it would make it a lot clearer. You know, there are institutions now that are charging $105,000 a year for college, right? Mm. And I think if you, you know, make that clear to parents that, like, we were talking about a $500,000 investment. That's a lot like the lungs on the top of those European cigarette packages, right? And I think it makes people look a little differently at some of these other schools where the price might be more justifiable. So yeah, I'm all for this.
Jeff, it was your idea. What's the biggest obstacle in the way, and how are you going to clear that hurdle quickly before we move on to Julie's big idea?
Well, I think some of it is what Julie mentioned is about the business model of higher education, right? It really requires you to be able to discount students at different rates. And if you don't know who is in your application pool, you can't really do that in advance. So I think it's the current business model of higher education really, unfortunately, doesn't support this idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let me just read our question of the day again. And as we do a quick reset, what do you think are the biggest problems facing higher education? What's one thing you would fix? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTubers, you can put those big fix ideas in the chat. Jermise on Facebook says, it's the cost. Education should not be expensive. That's what she says. I want to bring in another caller. We have India, who's located just outside of Philly. India, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me. My question is, I'm wondering if there's any work looking at community colleges and local state colleges incorporating more co-op and internship programs to help equalize the playing field. So, for example, my daughter is a highly successful student. She was admitted to a very elite school, but she did not receive the funds to allow us for her to go there. And so she ended up going to a local state school. And while she doesn't have the debt now and she had a good experience there, she does not have access that she would have had she gone into this elite school that provides a co-op program. So I feel like it's another example of just the financial inequity really putting up barriers to highly qualified people, because you don't have the opportunities that you would get.
Yeah.
You know, if you were through an internship program and networking.
And thank you, India. We're going to throw this.
Thank
you, India. I think we have a gist on your question. Thank you for that. And we'll throw it to you, Julie, because I know your first big fix kind of dealt a little bit with this.
Yeah.
Could you answer that? And then we'll flip it to your second.
Well, I agree completely that, you know, one of the biggest issues is our students having experiences that prepare them to meet their aspirations, which for most of them is a career. They want to work in a certain area. And so I do think we need to get better at, and I think my second big idea is kind of related to this as well, providing those co-ops and internships. I would argue that there are non-elite schools that offer, that actually are a distinctive feature of them, is that they focus on internships and co-ops. And people might be surprised to realize how many schools offer co-ops and internships but now it does require that students, you know, seek those things out. But I, as I argued earlier, I think they should be built into the curriculum.
So I
absolutely agree. I think we're talking about really recognizing that it needs to be more than what happens in the classroom, that we really need to rethink what we're trying to accomplish and why students don't.
Yeah. And I think this is a perfect segue into your second big fix idea. And, you know, you call for more focus. So go right ahead. Lay out the problem and your solution.
I think it's very related to these questions and comments about cost. And because I agree that that's a really big challenge. And even when you get a discount at many institutions, you still have what we call a gap, a certain amount of money you have to pay, which if you aren't from a wealthy family, a $5,000 gap is insurmountable. So I think we really need to think about how we reduce costs. I think this is more broadly, and this is grounded in a question about what is our purpose as a sector. I think we need to define the core mission of our institutions to provide that focus and control costs. And I think we've really lost our way, and that has contributed to increasing costs.
So give us an example of a school that you think maybe lost a little bit of focus and re, you know, stating the mission with sort of rein things in and control costs.
Give well, us an example. I mean, it's actually hard to think of an example because I think the focus here is on growth. We think growth is good. I think one of the examples, there's so many affiliated activities that institutions do. So they have athletics, they have health centers, they have fitness centers, they have counseling centers, they have costly extracurriculars.
Right.
In other countries, universities have the classroom and the lab.
So you're saying, you know, I'm University X. I'm going to go out there and say, I'm going to be the best at chemical engineering. Come here for chemical engineering and focus on this and you'll do well in that field.
That More is a of that piece sort of it. Focus? I think that's, so I think there's two things. It's one is what is our mission and how do we focus on that? It doesn't have to be one program.
Right.
But I think we have to get rid of all these costly activities that aren't mission central. Now, if I was an institution that was focused on residential life, I would want housing and I'd probably need to have some kind of wellness center, but I don't have to operate that myself. I can partner with someone else. But if we think about athletics, Division I athletics, for example, more than 95%, about 95% of Division I athletics institutions lose money on athletics.
Right. Well, look, can we kick it to Jeff? Because Arizona State is a D1 organization with a lot of students that does a lot of things. So Jeff, how do you think about this idea?
Well, I actually agree with Julia. My next big idea was kind of the end of the comprehensive university for
everyone. Well, lay it out.
We talk about this idea of college, but we don't really define what it really is. And everybody, and this goes back to Tyler's point about the rankings, everybody else wants to become somebody else. And what they want to become is this idea of the big residential comprehensive university. We're going to offer every major in the book, even though 80% of students major in 20% of the majors being offered. You know, we have to offer 26 sports teams, all this stuff. And at some point, we have to decide, what are we here for? What are we actually good at? And what do we want to spend money on, right? The Ivies, for example, spend about $80,000 per student on administration. Now, they have a lot of money to do that, but this is the problem, is that everybody else wants to become that. And so what I would love to do is see more differentiation in the marketplace, right? We talk about regional publics, we talk about community colleges, but again, they all look alike in many ways. And so just like in any other market, you have, you know, you have the top end restaurants, you have meat, you know, you have mid-ranked restaurants and lower end restaurants. But by the way, you can get quality food at a lot of them. I want to see the same thing where I can get a quality education for what I really need at this institution and stop trying to be like everyone else.
So
you cannot believe anyway.
So what this means, and I'm just trying to envision this. So what are you saying is that there would be schools, you know, Julie and Jeff, that would have, they don't have athletics, they don't have all that, but they may have really good education programs and churn out teachers. Is that what you're trying to say?
And they might be focused on a couple of different aspects of that, right? Maybe they focus on healthcare and teaching, and others focus on business and communication. Mm-hmm. But everybody doing everything or trying to do everything, A, raises costs, and I will say, not high quality in all of these different
Tyler, do you have a perspective on this? What have you seen firsthand?
Yeah, I agree with this completely. I think there is absolutely no reason, as somebody who has been at a small college that is Division III athletics, there's no reason for a college like the one I taught at to have athletic programs. There's no reason for it to require multimillion-dollar sports facilities. None of these kids are going to be professional anything. And it's completely superfluous, right? And it ratchets up cost for basically no benefit whatsoever. And there's no reason to have it. And that's true at all sorts of institutions around the country where you often don't need these kinds of programs.
But little Johnny wants to play shortstop for the D3 team, Tyler. He's gonna go to the school down the
Some
road.
Schools,
then.
This just let yeah, it go. Well, let it go.
Yeah, tough. I mean, sorry. Lots of people want to do lots of things. On top of that, I mean, just to sort of piggyback off Jeff's point, I think you need, and Julie's point, I think you need mass firings of administrators and the closings of all sorts of centers, institutions on campus. There is all sorts of absolute fluff that has nothing to do with the educational mission. There are, I'm just going to be rude, people at every college in this country whose jobs have no reason to exist, that if you talk to them, they would not be able to explain coherently what they do all day because they do basically nothing useful. And they just got to go. And I am not a libertarian, but when I talk about higher ed administrators, they sound like a libertarian. We need mass layoffs, closing a lot of stuff, and shrinking many of these institutions down to the core function of educating students.
And Julie, I want to give you the thought, like, y'all are just in alignment right here.
No, I agree completely. So I think one thing related to playing sports, you can play sports, but the college doesn't have to offer it.
Right.
There are, you know, look at what kids do in high school where they're on, there's club teams, there's other activities they can join. This doesn't have to be run by the higher ed institution, nor do many of these other costly extra things that they do. So I think we need to keep that in mind. I absolutely agree that we do need to end up with transparently differentiated institutions that do the things they do really well and don't try to be the comprehensive university. But I also think that we need to pay attention to the number of administrators. I absolutely agree. I think institutions have increased the number, just as we're paying football coaches a lot of money. Administrators are another issue.
You're at UPenn. Are you going to go back today and say, okay, here are the 100 people we can let go of today?
Well, that is not my job, but I certainly teach about
that
this.
Is not my job.
But you can educate.
No, I talk about this all the time, actually, and I'm pretty transparent about it, that, you know, we have many, many, many layers of bureaucracy and administration that have grown. We grow, and we don't think about, do we really need this? Now, I want to say that some of the administrators, the growth in the past decades is because of federal compliance. So new laws, mm-hmm. Somebody has to deal with that. But we don't need the number and many layers of administration that we have. So if we were to think about the core mission, I think part of this controlling costs is about rethinking the number of administrators that are needed, thinking really what we can do well, thinking about if we're focused on teaching great faculty. Somebody said that in the comments. I think that there is huge potential here, but it's almost like we have to break everything and start over. That's really what I think we kind of need to think about.
And we're going to put a pin in that and move on because we're about to go to break. Austin says, with the vast majority of Division I college sports programs operating at a massive deficit, everyday students are routinely forced to cover the shortfalls through mandatory fees and tuition subsidies. Given the skyrocketing cost of higher ed, isn't it time we require universities to completely separate their athletic budgets from academic funds? Yeah. That's a big fix right there. By the way, what do you think are the biggest problems facing higher education? What's one thing you would fix? 888-477-9499, studio2@whyy.org. And we got one more big fix idea coming up after the break.
Let's talk tech.
Yeah, we'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Avi Wolfman. Aaron, before we jump back into the conversation about big fixes in higher ed, it's time to reveal our Studio 2 Giveaway Wednesday event. Al, hit it! Can somebody tell me how to get things back the way they used to be? Oh God, give me. I had my little lighter lit. That is, of course, On Bended Knee by Boyz II Men. The Philly Legends are playing the Highmark Man with the Philly Pops on Friday night, September 18th. Two tickets in the main section under the pavilion. We'll run you about $200. But if you are the eighth person to email studio2@whyy.org, you'll get a pair for free on us. Lovely deal there, Cherry.
That's a great deal.
Now back to our conversation about fixing higher education. We've been kicking around big ideas this hour with Julie Wallman, President Emerita of Widener University and Professor of Practice at the University of Pennsylvania. Also Tyler Austin Harper, staff writer for The Atlantic and former professor at Bates University. And Jeff Salingo, who is the author of Dream School, Finding the College That's Right for You, and a special advisor to the president at the University, or Arizona State University. I almost said University of Arizona, Jeff. You would
two separate schools.
You hit me on that one.
Two separate schools. They don't like each other.
Very different.
And by the way, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What do you think are the biggest problems facing higher education? What's one thing you would fix? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can comment in the live chat. We're going to try to squeeze in a caller or two before we get our last big fix idea. We have Aaron from Villanova on the line. Aaron, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you, guys. I've been listening, and I just wanted to get my two cents, which is that I think this is really tying into the job market. Not that it's on y'all to fix that, but, you know, I have a bachelor's and a master's from, like, big tier one research university, big state uni, and now I'm at law school. And, I mean, coming out of that, there's so much uncertainty around jobs and how that program is actually going to transition into a job from my master's.
Yeah.
And, like, it's impossible to make that investment where it's, well, obviously not impossible, but so much more difficult when you don't know what's going to come of it.
A lot of uncertainty.
There's so much. And, I mean, also a lot of, I think, pessimism about, like, how a program turns into a job. And, you know, increasingly, like, things are not being valued or funded the way that they used to be, like research, you know, industry research positions, government research positions.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not there.
Thank you. That's Aaron from Villanova. A lot of uncertainty in the job market makes it hard for people to want to make these big investments. And so we have, thank you for that, Aaron. And, you know, Tyler, I know we have one more big fix idea. You can always respond to what you heard Aaron say, but then also lay out your second big fix.
Yeah, I think my second big fix actually relates to the question of the job market. I mean, I think AI is an existential threat for mass education in this country. I think colleges and universities are sleepwalking into a disaster, which is that at institutions around the country, they're allowing their students to cheat through a four-year degree. They are, in many cases, giving them the tools to cheat. Many universities provide free institutional access to premium AI programs. At a certain point, parents are going to look at this and say, why am I expected to pay 30, 40, 50, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, or $400,000 cumulatively for my kid to cheat through school for 4 years? And then why are employers going to, if you're an employer, you can't look at a student graduating in the year of our Lord 2026 and say that is the same quality of student who graduated before AI 5 years ago, right? You simply cannot. You know that student is very likely to have heavily used AI to get through school. So in order to protect the reputations of these institutions, and also to get parents to keep paying for their kids to go there and to get employers to continue taking these graduates seriously, you have to radically do everything in your power to detect the schools.
So how do you detect? That's radical, but I mean, I'm with you, Tyler. How do you detect the school in 2026? How do you do it?
It will look very different at big schools and small schools. At small schools like the one I taught at that are primarily residential, you have a lot of control over the students. No Wi-Fi on campus. No smartphones on campus.
Wow.
Everything is the Ethernet. Return to the 1990s. We are not talking about the 19th century. Through the early 2000s, computer-based work was done in computer labs. We can return to that model again, right? At bigger schools that are non-residential, where you have a distributed population, obviously you can't control their internet access, but you can still do very limited Wi-Fi on campus. You can still do things like oral exams, blue books in classrooms, et cetera. No screens, no laptops, no accommodations for those things whatsoever, right? The thing I think, and I've written about this before, every institution needs to ask what they can do is going to be different, again, depending on their resources and what kind of institution they are. But every institution should ask, what is the maximalist thing I can do to get AI and tech off this campus? And I'm going to do the maximalist thing.
I love the big thinking, Tyler. Jeffrey Salingo, do you think it's realistic?
that's a big idea about it. I do agree with Tyler is that higher education has been sleepwalking through AI. I think that they felt like it would go away, or then they wanted to police it. Where I think the problem is that maybe I'll disagree with Tyler's fix here a little bit, in that the workforce is requiring students to use this technology. Where I think higher ed needs to figure out is like, what is the responsible use? You know, I think students have always been cheating. This is just yet another technology that's helping them. So
this is next level cheating now.
Yeah, I think where the fix needs to come in is that higher education needs to get its hands around this and figure out what is responsible use of AI? How do we teach students that responsible use? How do we be more transparent to talk about this, both from the professor side and from the student side? Because by the way, professors are also using it. I've talked to professors who use it to grade. They use it in very irresponsible ways, in my opinion. So I feel like having a campus by campus conversation about this, coming up with more parameters, more guardrails around this is going to be important. I don't necessarily agree with totally banning it or really.
Well, to be clear, sorry, I could have said, I totally agree that AI needs to be taught and that like employers expect it. I just think that can be done in computer labs and in dedicated formats rather than just this like free-for-all of AI chaos that we're
and Julie, fair enough, because I do think there's chaos right now.
And Julie, love to get your tap in on
this. I mean, I absolutely agree. I think institutions do not know what to do about this. They're trying to figure it out. They not ready, and it changes every day. And you know, today we have Bill Gates coming out saying this is terrifying, like where this is going to go. So those who really know how it works are saying this is a real problem. But I don't think I agree. Like it completely de-teching every campus is probably not realistic and maybe not appropriate. But if we think about differentiated institutions. So there can be institutions, and there are, you know, this is quite doable where, because there are students who don't want to use AI. It's, we're talking as if they all use it. They don't all use it. There is a decent, percentage of students who don't like it, don't want to use it, and would perhaps choose an institution that said, we are like what Tyler's talking about. That's what they want. That's the place they want to go. Another place may lean into teaching responsible use of AI. I think our problem is we've just let it go. And instead of saying it clearly, like this is how you can use it effectively. And I agree with Jeff too that.
And we got to wrap up.
I would just say like, if we say we don't want students to use AI, we shouldn't be using it ourselves. Yeah. And that's a real ethical issue.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And by the way, de-teching higher ed, cost transparency, and focusing higher ed.
Higher ed has a lot of things to think about.
That last voice you heard was Julie Wolman, President Emerita of Widener University. You also heard from Tyler Austin Harper, staff writer for The Atlantic and former professor at Bates College. And last but not least, you also heard from Jeff Salingo, author of Dream School, Finding the College That's Right for You.
Yeah, our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Today's show is engineered by Mike Schiffler and Al Banks. From Studio 2, I'm Kevin McCrory.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And this last song that you're hearing is by the one and only Dolly Parton, who passed away this week. May she rest in peace. She was so loved by many on our team and all across the world. Thank you so much.